The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
From the Gateless Gate, Case 23. The sixth ancestor was pursued by Ming, the head monk, as far as Dayu Peak. The teacher, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take it back with you." Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." The teacher said, "Don't think good, don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had great satori. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bows, saying, "Beside these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" The teacher said, "What I have just conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." Ming said, "Though I practiced at Huangmei with the assembly, I could not truly realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointed instruction, I'm like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is cold or warm. Lay brother, you are now my teacher." The teacher said, "If you can say that, then let us both call Huangmei our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully." And Wu Man's comment on this koan: it must be said that the sixth ancestor forgets himself completely in taking action here. He's like a kindly grandmother who peels a fresh lychee, removes the seed, and puts it into your mouth. Then you only need to swallow it down. And Wu Man's verse: it can't be described. It can't be pictured. It can't be praised enough. Stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. So yesterday we heard about this koan and the beautiful backstory from Alan Sensei, and then the connection to Rohatsu from David Roshi. And today I want to look once again, as if we were making a bit of a circle back, to the koan itself, to this encounter between two human beings who were, even though they lived such a long time ago, so much like us. Every time I hear this koan, I get caught up in the story of both Ming and the sixth ancestor. The openness, as some of you said yesterday, of the sixth ancestor generously giving of himself to this desperate person. This desperate person, Ming, who thought he knew what he was going for. We talk a lot in Zen about not having goals, but of course we all have goals, and we have directions, and we have intentions. The intentions, when they are really fully, heartfully committed to, lead us to surprising places, not where we thought we would be ending up. And if all of us here, and for some of us it's a bit of a memory stretch, but for some of us it's a little bit easier, if we all remember the first time we heard about Zen And then the first time we decided to follow the way of Zen, which may have been separate in time. My first encounter with Zen was when I was a teenager, and I was looking around for meaning in my life because I'd had a number of difficult things that had happened to me, and I wanted to know the truth of reality. I wanted to know why people did the things they did, said the things they did, what was going on. I often felt like a stranger in a strange land. I didn't understand human culture very well. Later, I studied anthropology, and I thought that would help. It just let me know that there are vast numbers of cultures all over the world that are also impenetrable. And I had a copy of the Encyclopedia Britannica in our house that my parents had bought with the idea that that would educate me. And it was kind of like the internet in a big bookcase. And I remember going through it, looking up every religion I could. And Zen was one of them, but it didn't grab me at the time. And then later, when I was in college, at my university as a freshman in my first year, I took a class from a teacher who later became a friend and a fellow performer in a dance company that David and I were in. But at the time, he was the scary religion professor, and he taught a class called Emptiness. And there were only 12 of us, and we encountered the Great Way through texts about Buddhism, Taoism. And he taught us to meditate, but it didn't stick with me. I didn't really believe in that path yet. Even after I met David, after college, and we became a couple, and we went to see a Zen teacher, a famous Zen teacher named Joshu Sasaki, who David actually later went to Sesshin with. And he was talking on a big stage. We were way at the back of a huge auditorium, and I didn't understand a word he said. It just seemed like nonsense to me. So all these little moments of touching into the Dharma, but they didn't really do it. And then it wasn't until I was in my late 20s that I met my first Zen teacher, and a friend taught me how to meditate, actually a friend who's still a member of our Sangha, who doesn't come and practice with us anymore. Some of you may remember Steve Kitts, and he was a massage therapist at the time, and I was very anxious about something, like no big surprise there. I get anxious about lots of things. And he said, "Oh, have you ever tried meditation after a massage?" And I said, "No," and I kind of rolled my eyes. And he said, "Oh, let me show you how to do it." And he just left me on the massage table sitting with my legs dangling off the edge and taught me basic breath practice. And it was remarkable. And when he came back with my bill, I said, "Oh my God, what was that?" And he said, "Oh, are you interested? Because my Zen teacher is giving an introduction to Zen this weekend. And let me tell you where it is." And David and I went to hear this teacher, and it was amazing. And that was a long time ago now. And all these years of practice, all these years of being exposed to the way, my intention originally was simply to understand what it meant to be human, and I wasn't doing a very good job of it. The encyclopedia, the class, the lecture, reading, learning how to meditate. It wasn't until that moment that something clicked in me on that massage table where I recognized there was something else that I couldn't find in the ordinary way. I couldn't find it through reading. I couldn't find it through study. I couldn't find it through other people telling me what to do. Right then and there, in that moment, I knew that everything I had been searching for was already here. But I couldn't have said that in that way back then. But something lit up And I thought, okay, I'm going to pursue this. And I stayed with Steve Kitz's teacher, Richard Clark, for 20 years. And he was a very, very wise and wonderful person, and also extremely flawed. And it took me a long time to get away. And then I met James Ford, who was almost in every single way the exact opposite of Richard Clark. And James took me under his wing, and he showed me another way to experience this reality that I'd been searching for. Richard had been very powerful, dynamic, aggressive, really. And James was kind and compassionate. And I was just recalling with one of you that when I ended up going to graduate school after this period, when I had started studying Zen, I specialized in grief, because my life had been full of grief, psychotherapy, because I wanted to be a counselor, and Zen, because I was practicing Zen. And my thesis was about two different styles of practice, Manjushri practice and Kanzeon or Guanyin practice. And I had really experienced these things. I hadn't yet met James Ford, but I knew about this. I had actually done a retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, who was also a wonderful exemplar of Guanyin practice, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And in the paper that I wrote, as I described the different ways that one could practice, this was based on my own experience. I actually didn't do any research for this paper. I just wrote about what I knew and what I'd already learned from sitting at Sashin, from practicing. And the Guanyin practice, the Avalokiteshvara practice, is the practice of evoking compassion, the heart that opens naturally, that recognizes that everything we have ever wanted has been here the whole time. It's unbelievable, really. The ordinary mind, the ordinary brain, I should say, doesn't really understand that. But there was something that I had sensed myself on that massage table when I first brought my attention to the breath in the base of my abdomen, just like Steve taught me. Something I recognized, something that had always been present, but that I hadn't seen. This is the Guanyin practice. When anything arises in the mind that's distressing, in this style of practice, we embrace it and allow it to move along. We don't cling to anything, but we also don't do anything. We continue to sit in the presence of things that are arising and things that are falling away. And in the Manjushri practice, which I had really learned from my first teacher, the Manjushri practice is the wisdom practice. Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, is often depicted carrying a sword. In fact, there's one here in our Sashin Zendo, sitting above a Guanyin on the mantle that's above the fireplace behind the Enos. And the sword of Manjushri cuts through all delusion. It doesn't open its arms wide and say, yes, yes, yes. It says, no, not this. And I remember writing this paper, recognizing even back then, the truth of what Wei Nang is talking about here. When I first heard this koan, and I heard what Wei Nang asked of Ming, think neither good nor evil at this very moment. What is the original face? Even just hearing those words, I heard something that confirmed things that I'd already experienced but had never found words for. I knew the truth of Wei Nang's challenge, and also Ming heard it directly. It was a bit of a sword of Manjushri cutting through his intention to get the robe and bowl, to undo the injustice that his teacher, Hungren, had perpetrated on the whole Sangha, this southerner, this illiterate rice thresher, woodcutter, given the robe and bowl of Bodhidharma? Unbelievable. Not okay. But when he was confronted with that pile of robe and bowl on the rock, and this big, strong man, the former general, tried to lift it up, he couldn't do it. He was ineffective. I imagine he was someone who was good at a lot of things, probably good at being a general, and then later good at being a monk, good at being a person of the way. He probably remembered all the different ways of bowing and hand-holding and all the different forms of Zen. He's probably an expert at it. He knew so much. And he had formed that intention to right the wrong. And here he was, with all his might, he couldn't lift that bowl and robe. And then when he turned to Wei Nung and asked him for instruction, Wei Nung recognized right away a certain kind of ripeness. I know as a teacher, when I encounter someone to that degree of ripeness, I feel so relieved. At last, I can point to something. Teachers have funny roles because we're not really imparting anything. We're just pointing things out. But somebody has to be willing to have things pointed out. And Ming at that moment was completely willing, I think partly because in my mind, when I identify with Ming, he had lost everything, all his strategies and all his ways of being a person in the world that had gotten him to a certain place. They were no longer working. He couldn't lift it. I can feel that moment in my own back and arms. How could this light thing, this bowl and this robe, suddenly be so heavy that it was impossible to lift it up? And so he turns to Wei Nung with nothing left. He has run out of strategies. He's probably also, in spite of the fact that he was probably very athletic and strong, and he was exhausted. One of the things I love about Sesshin is that it exhausts us. We never get enough sleep, even if we sleep really well, and I know some of you are sleeping really well, and I know some of you are not sleeping really well. It doesn't make any difference. It's long hours of, I think Laura said this the first night, we don't know how hard we're working and we have to hydrate. Well, I don't think that Ming stopped to hydrate on his journey up that mountain to get to Wei Nung. He was exhausted. He was worn out, wrung out. And this is the condition we have to be in order to receive the teachings, which are nothing special. He just said, Wei Nung just said, don't think about good and evil. Just stop getting caught up in all these dualities, as we talked about yesterday in our wonderful Dharma dialogue. Notice them, and then look to see if you can be aware of your own original face. The person beneath the layers of personhood that we have all covered ourselves over with, the little beating heart of love and compassion and wisdom that lives inside all of us. When we think, when I think about what I've been aiming for all my life, and especially before I found Zen, I think I've always wanted what I've always had, but what I didn't know that I had. And this, of course, is what the main teaching of Buddhism is. I forgot in my own story an interesting moment that happened before I met my first teacher, before Steve Kitts showed me how to meditate. I was at a beach vacation with my family, with my mother and her friend and my friend, and we had a series of really awful things happen that I won't go into, but then we went to a book sale, and for 10 cents, I picked up a book about Zen. I still have it. It's by D.T. Suzuki, the great explicator of Rinzai Zen in America in the early part of the 20th century. And when I look at it now, every single line is underlined with dark black lines. And I don't underline books, but man, this book, everything, I kept, wow, look at this. And I read it to my mother and her friend and my friend. And they went, oh, yeah, huh? It wasn't doing it for them. But it really did start to open the way for me, so that when I did meet our first teacher, I heard him. I was in that place where I really was ready to hear the teaching. I hadn't been in that place before. And I think that Ming wasn't in that place before, even though he was a monk at a monastery and he had a teacher, and somehow nothing had gotten through to him. Which kind of explains later when he says, wow, you are an amazing teacher. I mean, he didn't say that, but that's the implication. You've really opened me up. You know, I get it now. I know when water is warm or cool by drinking it. You know, this direct experience. Thank you for pointing it out. And Weinong does not take that bait. He doesn't say, yeah, I know. I am a pretty great teacher. I really showed you the way. He said, no, our teacher is Hungren. We're both students of the way. Let's both call him our teacher. They wander off, and famously, according to this, the legendary truth, or whatever I called it yesterday, Weinong had been told by Hungren to not teach for a number of years. I think it was 6 years, but I can't remember. And so he spent time in the forests wandering around. But Ming, as far as we know, we don't really know much about him, probably went back and kept studying with Hongren. But I imagine that his Zazen was quite different then. He had this taste of opening. He thought it was something. And there's another little section in this story that I find so beautiful. He says to Weinong after his great awakening, is there something else? Now that I know the secrets, is there something else, another secret you haven't told me? And Weinong says, what I have shown to you is not secret. None of this is secret. It's all present, right here, right now. This is what the Buddha saw after his long night. The tradition I know is he spent a whole night, but really some people say days and days, and if you look at his life, you could say years and years. As David Roshi explained to us yesterday, he tried everything. The Buddha tried all of the teachings on the spiritual marketplace of his time. 2,600 years ago, there was still this human longing for understanding, finding a way to get what it means to be human, and he did that, and nothing satisfied him. This is such a hallmark of a serious Zen practitioner, to not be satisfied by anything until the genuine article presents itself, whatever it is. And people tell stories about seeing flowers and hearing birds and tasting something and whatever it is. The Buddha himself, seeing the morning star, Venus, up in the sky just before the sun rises, when the sky is at its darkest, and there's this little glimmer of light that shines down. He saw it without anything getting in the way. Nothing interfered, because he had run out of strategies. All night fighting off the demons, Mara's minions, all these things that tempted him, and then nothing was left. Maybe he was as exhausted as Ming was. He'd been wrung out. This is what we're doing here. We're getting wrung out. We're putting down all of the ways that we protect ourselves and the ways we fool ourselves, all of the ways that we prevent ourselves from seeing what's right in front of us, from hearing what's right here, from feeling it, smelling it, tasting it. Everything already present, being offered to us. The world offers itself to us, the poet Mary Oliver says. We don't have to go after it. We don't have to be brave and strong and run up that mountain and get what's ours. It's already ours. We already have it. And as Ochyama Roshi says in the title of his wonderful book, Opening the Hand of Thought, in a way, there's a way that we're clutching at things. Linji says, don't grope for it. Wumen says, don't grope for it. Don't go after it. Open your hand and see that it's right here. Come into encounters with open hands, open eyes, open heart. Now, it takes a lot to do that because all of us have been damaged and hurt in so many ways, not damaged in the sense of broken permanently, but hurt. It's just what it's like to be a human being and live with other human beings in the world as children and then again as adults. It's hard to trust. It's hard to open. As we said yesterday, this really hurts. This opening to our own strategies and patterns and ways we prevent ourselves from tasting water and knowing for ourselves whether it's warm or cool. Later in the commentary, when Wumen says that Huineng is like a kindly grandmother who peels the lychee nut and takes out the pit and pops it into our mouths, and all we have to do is swallow it. This is what we're talking about here. The Dharma is right out on the table. It's taking the form of the light on the floor. It's taking the form of the person near you breathing. It's taking the form of bells and bird song and the stillness and silence of the room and the coolness of the air. It's taking the form of rice and dates and crackers and cheese and peanut butter. It's taking the form of your cushion or your chair right now, holding you up. We are being supported by something that can't be named, that can't be understood in the ordinary way of understanding. I can't say for myself that I learned what I was hoping to learn. I formed that intention to learn how human beings are, studying anthropology and psychology and religion. I don't think I got to my goal. But what I did reach was a place that I'd always been. Your original face is your home, your true home. And it's right here. Don't go off somewhere else into the past or the future. Oh gosh, we do that all the time. When we do it, let that happen and then return. Return to this. Only this. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll reconfigure the Zendo into our oval, and Ray and Anne come forward. Thank you. Everybody knows what to do. So please, you know what to do. Raise your physical hand. I will call on you. Yes, Will.
Thank you for the talk. My mind kept going back to something that I had not understood and kind of flipped over or only half understood. And I guess I sort of want to talk about it because I sort of get it, but I'm not sure. And that is, why does he start with, especially when it's translated good and evil? I mean, evil is a very strong word, right? And I kept thinking, well, why does he say that first? Why does he say don't think good or bad? And then I guess I thought, well, maybe, I mean, I understand, you know, I could tell myself, well, Zen is always telling you contradictory things, but that's not very satisfying. It's sort of like those stand for almost everything, right? We lean towards whatever we feel is the good thing, and we lean away from, and there's always something that we think is less good, right? So is it sort of that? Does it sort of stand for the ways that we decide where to go when actually no decision is necessary and there's nothing to do? Is that the... No? How do we... Do you get my question? Why does he say, don't think good, don't think evil?
Yeah, and I appreciate all the different ways that you're trying to figure this out.
Yeah.
And none of them really resonate with me.
Okay.
But I wonder if Alan or David has something.
Well, one thing I wanted to point out, Will, is that he doesn't say, don't think good, don't think evil. He says something in Chinese.
Right.
And this translator translated it as evil, and then we hear that, and we got our whole Judeo-Christian, you know, traditions.
Yeah.
Suddenly pulsating, but so we can put all that aside. But thinking about, you know, Ming, is he or is he not at this moment before, as he arrives at the mountain, is he or is he not a person of right and wrong? And I would say, yeah, he's really a person of right and wrong.
Yeah.
That's why he's chasing Weinan. And is this an advantage for a spiritual awakening or a disadvantage to be a person of right and wrong? That's where I would go with it. And, you know, has it helped you to be a person of right and wrong? Has it helped any of us?
It kind of sucks.
You know, thank you. That what Alan said is really wonderful.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking along those lines, but it's so deeply true, right? This is what brought him. That was his intention, was to right a wrong.
Right.
And also, anybody who had ordained as a monk at that time would have taken the precepts. And we actually, in Boundless Way, have in our three pure precepts, the first two are to avoid evil and to practice good.
Okay.
So whatever the Chinese version of that was back then, there is some way that there's the non-dual, which we have to open to, but there's also, no, don't kill people, and don't steal from people, and don't hurt people, and all that, right? So it would have been shorthand, I think, to Ming, to hear that, you know, so you're a monk, you've taken the precepts, you've devoted your life to this, I'm asking you to put all of that aside. That's just another way of thinking about it. And the thing that's wonderful about koans is that you can't chew on them like this. You really can, and I congratulate you for it. And ultimately, you have to be Ming. you know. And I loved Alan's question to you just now, how has it been to be a person of right and wrong, right? It kind of sucks. Yeah, for me it sucks big time.
It's sort of what I was trying to say, but Alan said it so much better. Yeah, well, thank you, yeah.
I liked what you both said. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Craig.
Well, thank you for the talk. That'll be one that I'll listen to again. I was struck with you, just when our stratagems are used up, what an opportunity that is. And I think usually I think when I have exhausted all my mental gymnastics to figure something out, that's a problem.
Yeah.
But it's almost like where we just talked about, we, at the end of the road there's an iron wall, that, okay, I give up. And that is the time to notice what's happening.
Yeah, I think this paradoxical breakdown, right, as long as we have stratagems, and I remember once encouraging people to abandon stratagems, and another teacher said at the same time, no, keep all your stratagems, try them as hard as you can, right? Just keep going, because there is something about this exhaustion, you know, and we think, oh, if I just do it a little bit harder. Yeah, go for it. See how it works out. And we think, oh, the iron wall, oh, that's really bad. But that's the beginning, mm-hmm. right? As long as we think there's some way out, we're lost. But to bear that place, you know, because we get there and think, oh, let me back up and I'll try another, because there's got to be a more skillful, right? And then we go around the corner, and so we go in and out so much, eventually we come there and think, oh, here I am, maybe I'll stay here. Yeah. Thank you.
I did want to add quickly, though, Craig, that for the reasons that you said, I've always been really grateful that we have a week-long summer sesshin, because that really gives you a chance to exhaust your stratagems. And, you know, we have our 3 weeks in the summer now, and people who do those 3 weeks or two of them really, really feel the difference. So, not that I wanted to give a plug for the 3 weeks, but somehow I find myself doing so. So thank you for raising that.
And you know, not just that, but our new sesshin schedule that we've come to since the pandemic, there's an opportunity to do a sesshin every month, which for me means that my ordinary life and my sesshin life are not so separate anymore. And just, there's an opportunity to do formal practice every day, either once or twice. It really helps me to keep, I've been rung out over and over and over again. And there's something about the structure of formal practice that I think Ellen is pointing out.
And it will all be taken away. The iron wall is coming for us all. So yeah, I love practice and think so useful, but even if you do every sesshin, you're still going to have a problem. And this is the good news.
Thank you. David Kursa.
Since yesterday, and it was, I didn't know this koan or this story, and really appreciated Alan's whole very nice background of the story. And today your talk really wedged into the same area that's been really sticking for me, and that is what happened when Ming got there and saw Huainong, that opened up a little gap, you know, in his certainty. You know, he's like, I guess we all are, you know, where there are certain many things that we're just so sure of, and it's hard to break them. Often tragically we never do it.
Yeah.
But something happened just then in that encounter. And it seemed to me something like all Huainong had to say was, you can take them.
Yeah.
And that was so counterintuitive, and it completely obliterated all of Ming's constructs about what he was up and who he was and what led him up the mountain and all the causes and conditions unfindable, you know, that led to that moment.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's the, you know, that kind of unexpected occurrence, the surprise. My first teacher always used to say, may you be surprised, right? That whatever we expect does blind us. Because we already know what's going to happen. You know, oh, every time I go to Sesshin, the first night it's like this, and then the second night it's like that, and whatever. But it's not ever like that. Anyone who's been to more than one Sesshin can start to see through that particular delusion. And there's a way that I think this story, I mean, how old is this story, right? It's at least from the Song Dynasty, way after Wei Nung lived. It was written down. Wu Men, you know, lived in the 1200s and wrote it down then. So what is that? I don't know, 600 years later. But why has it stuck with us? Why is it such a resonant story? And even though it's your first time hearing it, it clicks so fast. Many of us have heard it before. And I think it's because many or all of us have had that moment of being surprised, of being shocked out of the ordinary. And so when we hear the story, we go, yeah, yeah, right. So then what happens? It like pulls us. All the great myths and stories have moments like this. But this one, why? Why do we keep telling it? I think it's quite wonderful.
It also made me reflect a lot since yesterday on all those times when nothing did snap me out of my religion.
Exactly.
Painful, not just for me, but for others.
Oh, and we all have that experience.
Convictions, you know.
Well, and I think that speaks to the need for determination on this path, and also a kind of patience with our unfolding. All of us have a sense of how quickly we should unfold and when the story should get to this point and that point. And that's just none of our business. You know, we get to work with what's here right now. And if we're not surprised, we can be surprised at being not surprised. And things happen. And that's not our... that's not our business, but this open-hearted again and again. And then I think we do find over time doing this practice and living that certain things wear out. You know, we've done it enough times and we wish it was, you know, maybe fewer times than we've done it. But at a certain point, on some things, we begin to have that little bit of separation. And sometimes it's not a dramatic thing. It's so gradual, we don't even know there's any separation until something happens. Oh, you know, 10 years ago, I would have responded differently. So both sudden and gradual in that way. And this importance over time of a clear direction.
Thank you. Madhu?
Yeah, so this moment when Ming really gets what he wants, right, and just kind of reminds me of all those times in my life when, you know, like this wanting is there, you know, going after what we really like. But, you know, the shadow of that is that we also don't want things that we really want. And, you know, the misfortune of getting what you really want. Yeah. And you're like, oh no, I don't want it anymore. So, you know, so this kind of reminded me of that. And, yeah. So it's good to hold both those sides.
Yeah, because I think we all have make up some stories, if only. If only I had this life situation. If only I had this understanding. If only I had a raksu of that color. And all of this stuff, whatever we get, it's ultimately wonderfully disappointing. Right? So get it, don't get it.
And I think all of internet commerce is based on this principle. You know, just get sucked into the internet, and there's beautiful digitized pictures of the very things we want, and then they show up. There's a great folk singer, I can't remember her name, but she wrote a song called What Was I Thinking? It's about all the stuff she gets through the mail. But yeah. So there is something about greed. We were talking about greed yesterday, and how it does transform into compassion. But it's like, here's the intention and the goal again, right? The goal is, I want that pink dress with the roses on it. I really want it. It's beautiful on the internet. And then it shows up and it's like, what was I thinking? And that we think that we make up all kinds of stuff about the Dharma, don't we? Yeah, Matt.
Yeah, I can't remember. Thank you for all the talks and for being able to spend time with this wonderful story. I don't remember the exact line, but before he says take it, he says something about the Dharma is not held in the robe, something like that.
This robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it.
Right, right. Thank you. So there's a way in which he also kind of like, he kind of bores into Ming's true intent. Ming thinks he wants the robe and bowl, but he goes, that's not what you really want. And Ming is kind of like thrown by that, and that's like there's a truth in that he's able to kind of see that he wasn't expecting at all, because he's just been focused on robe bowl, you know, this whole time. You know?
And doesn't he say, I came for the Dharma, not for the robe?
Yeah, and then he it's like, oh, you got me.
Oh, wow. So I don't even know what that means.
Yeah.
That's great.
And then after all that, it's like what he can't move it. It's, yeah, there's something amazing about
that. Yeah, when we work with this koan and formal koan practice, you know, there's these steps that we go through, because every twist and turn is really significant. And I love that, pointing that part out. There's many moments when Ming is opened. Yeah, it's quite just like us.
And what he's been running after is Bodhidharma's used clothing. And he suddenly realizes, I don't want Bodhidharma's used clothing, I want to meet Bodhidharma.
Yeah,
and that's quite different.
Nice. Yeah, and I think the same. Whatever you think enlightenment is, it's just Robin Bowl. I want to wake up. It's not that. That's not what you really want.
Thank you, Mara.
I was connected to what I was feeling yesterday, but. I was just struck by like the action aspect of this. I feel like in our world now, there's so much where I can just imagine this like being on the internet and everyone being like, can you believe that's the guy that got the robe? And
millions of people. Millions.
Pop in the comments. Like the worst Reddit you've ever read. But that's not like what happened. And that's also not what we do here. I mean, I know we're talking about it now, but like there's just this action, like go get it, experience it, like the tasting for yourself, like the water, and I love that we do that here, you know, like in a world where I feel like we just don't have that like action in our body and all of the imagery of the sweat and the just the physicality of realization just like strikes me.
I really like that. I hadn't really thought about it, but as soon as you started talking about it, my mind started going click, click, click. I mean, we live in a world that's very digitally oriented, and we don't ignore it. We're not Luddites, right? We don't say, no computers, nothing, because we're recording the talk right now. It's going to go on the internet. Right? People are going to listen, and they might have a hard time hearing you because, you know, doesn't pick you up. But, you know, there's something about allowing ourselves to be in the world and then making these conscious choices. And this is part of the precepts too. Be careful what you consume, right? You know, and some of us, it's designed for human brains to tempt us into nothing. I mean, it's really ridiculous. The games and the shopping and the everything. And we drop it here. We actually specifically ask you to shut off your devices. I've been noticing a bunch of people have phones on their wrists now, the smart, whatever they call them, smart watches. And I've been wondering even if we should put those away too. I couldn't live without it, right? Just for a few days, what would that be like? Use different technology. I'm not saying we're going to do it. Don't worry, Madhu. But it reveals the clinging, I guess. And it reveals the billions of followers of Ming who followed him up the mountain and, did clicks on his website.
Yeah, and this is not a philosophical enterprise. I appreciate you pointing to that. We're not sitting on the cushion trying to think about Zen, right? Because that's not so helpful. Could be interesting, you could be a Zen scholar, but we're looking into experience and not someone else's experience, right? And all these talks are not about, let me tell you how it is, but pointing to your experience, what you know. I think, what a wonderful antidote, what an important thing this is for us to do in this day and age.
I read something recently that the way that AI is going to kill us all is not by inventing some, bioterror weapon, but by coming up with things, that virtual things that are so addictive and so good at pushing all of our pleasure buttons that we'll just forget how to live. And so we do this practice that's not pushing our pleasure buttons. Sitting still in a movie for 25 minutes at a time. Yeah, sounds like fun. And it's the way of freedom. And so, keeping that in mind as these technologies get more and more subtle and devious at pulling us away from our lives, pulling us away from our bodies, pulling us away from pain and suffering, which turn out to be things that we need if we want to survive.
I was trying to remember this word the other day, talking to one of you. I think Zen and Sashin are a technology. Mm-hmm. Your technology for awakening, way before the digital age. Somebody figured this out, lots of people, and it's our inheritance. So I find it quite trustworthy, even though it's kind of weird.
And pushing some kind of very, very deep pleasure button. The pleasure
right.
Beyond pain and joy. Mm-hmm. This deep longing we all have, this inexplicable something is here that is so fantastic, right? Beyond anything. Now, what could compare sitting and breathing?
Yeah. Oh, right. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm thinking about my life and the strategies that you suggest we drop and. I tell myself stories. This is a wonderful one, but it's still a story. Mm-hmm. And it's like, the thing about stories is that they give me some comfort, some sense of moving forward in my life, So I like the story of my life, and I like the sashins and the insights that I get sort of like improve the quality of my life in some way. But it's all a story, and that's the strategy that I use to improve myself, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's be careful here. I don't think I am, and I don't think Alan or David are either, suggesting that we drop our strategies.
Right.
We need to fully enact them until they wear out. And so there's nothing wrong with stories and being comforted. Oh my goodness, this world is so hard. Life is so hard. But at a certain point, the thing, the true pleasure, as David was just pointing it out, is not accessible through those strategies. So we that's what we learn. I'm dropping this now. But it actually drops by itself. I don't really think we have the capacity to drop strategies. They're survival strategies. They're very deep in us. And they're good. You know, it's good to tell stories. It's good to sit around the fire and, you know, the all the human culture is based in stories. It's not a problem. But it is a problem when we use it to avoid something else that's deeper that we're longing for, I think. And so we just are not that powerful. We can't drop them, but we can get to know them really intimately. That's what we're doing. We're just like you just named them. Oh yeah, I do this and I do that and I do this. And okay, you know, here you go. Thank you. Thank you, strategies. You helped me survive to this point. You get me to Sashin. Got me to this moment in my life. So it's not about dropping. It's like really becoming intimate with them, you might say. Yeah. Yeah, Chad.
What comes to mind for me is like my mind makes so many stories all the time, right? And I think in other parts of life, for things that I like and enjoy, I have this sort of natural curiosity and passion to go like learn more, dig in deeper, right? And what I found this practice helps me to do is to kind of normalize that and try to have a little bit of that curiosity with everything that pops up. And it's hard, but it seems not easier, not the right word, but more able to be done in a shorter period of time, maybe, you know, for certain things. But I try to cultivate, that's how I think about it, this curiosity to say, what else is this thing trying to tell me, even if it's not a good thing, right? What can I be with this thing? And the words, you know, from the other day, all through this talk has been wonderful, but companion really, you know, stands out for me. And I think I mentioned to Melissa previously that I always think about these sides of myself that I categorize everything, you know, some are good and some are okay, and I want to do this and I don't want to do that, and just kind of holding hands with them, as opposed to, like, you know, kicking them to the curb or just, you know, clutching them. So I try to have this curiosity to all things, and it's an interesting place to see that.
That's a wonderful response to don't think good, don't think evil. And you just gave a little Dharma talk about that. And I agree that taking, instead of using the automatic sorting mechanism of I want, I don't want, good, bad, showing some curiosity about all of it, that's a wonderful practice.
And it is an example of a strategy, right? So if we're not thinking good or evil, then, strategies are just strategies. And so that will serve you for a while, and then it won't, because it's inventive. Yeah, so, but it's not a bad thing. It's important to know that these are survival mechanisms, and some of them are really skillful. Thank you.
Yeah, and this invitation, this don't think good, don't think evil, is this invitation... to be curious about everything. What is this? What is this? And that the mind will, you were saying, you know, we're so certain. Well, I know what this is. And so this questioning that comes up, what, you know, appreciate the story, you know, have convictions. But what is this here, right now? Yeah.
Thank you. Deb. Steve has to go off and cook, and we get, Deb will be the last one.
So what came up for me was, I really related to this whole Manjushri Kuan Yin thing, because my first center, the Rochester Zen Center, at Sashin, there was the Manjushri on the altar with the sword, and it was so much about, like, you know, not even wisdom, it felt like it was more about, you know, cutting and death, or anyway, but and for me, it really made me feel like little and tight and really not open, you know, just kind of like really afraid. And and then my second teacher, which was also there, but her name was Toni Packer, and she was definitely more open, compassionate. And there was this one session where I felt like I was having a heart attack because my heart was hurting so much. Mm. And she just said to me, "That is because your heart is breaking and opening." Mm. And it was like, oh yeah, this is what it's about. I mean, I love Zen even right from the beginning, even with the fear and everything, but you know, I didn't want to like leave, but there was just something, and he feels like here, there's a combination of the combination of really looking deeply and Manjushri and also the compassion. I just feel, really realize that it's this combination feels right.
Yeah.
So I just feel very grateful to everyone.
Well, and I do want to point out, we do have a Manjushri up there, and it's been the Boundless Way tradition to always have a Manjushri present at Sesshin, too.
Yeah.
We don't put him on the altar, we leave the Buddha there instead. But it is traditional for Zen communities to replace the Buddha with a Manjushri. It is the way it is. I love that we have this big Guanyin statue with the Manjushri behind it. If you haven't seen it, it's right above the fireplace here. Because to me, that is important. Don't think Kanon, don't think Manjushri, right?
Manjushri is smaller, though.
I'm sorry? Oh, yeah, because we don't have enough money to get a big one. It's true, they're pretty expensive.
Fundraising.
But actually, we've had the Manjushri for a really long time. We have Guanyins all through the temple. But that Guanyin is from Harold Stevens. After he died, his brother said, "Take what you want from the house." And that was the one that Corwin and I said, "Oh, can we have this?" And we put it up there. Yeah, so he's here too. And this is how it is. It's always a mixture of firm and gentle. And if we go too firm, and if we go too gentle, right? It's got to be both. So thank you all so much. Let's put the Zendo back together.